Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. The election's getting closer, the temperature's rising, and my guest today is just the person to help us understand why our politics can sometimes sound so scary. Mbali Ntuli is a remarkable woman. She grew up in KZN, KwaZulu-Natal, as the daughter of a taxi boss. When he died in 1996, she barely survived the ensuing family feuding, but she ended up in the Democratic Alliance Youth Section and rose through the ranks in both the provincial party and its national structures. She was a member of the provincial legislature in KZN, and she very boldly stood, I thought, for the national leadership against the establishment shoo-in, a current party leader, Johnson 2020. I'm afraid she lost, and probably equally predictably, she eventually left the party. Part, it turned out, of a significant number of black leaders to leave the party, the DA, after Musi Maimane departed following quite a poor 2019 election performance. But all that aside, Mbali Ntuli never joined another party, and rather she has rebuilt herself as founder and CEO of what she calls the Groundwork Collective, a community development NGO that focuses on civic education and participation, food production, skills development, and entrepreneurship. And Mbali Ntuli, thank you so much for joining me on Podcast from the Edge. You're also now, I read, recruiting election observers for the May 29th election. Well, that's a terrific idea. I mean, I hadn't thought of that, actually. People just doing it themselves. How many people are you looking for, and what status will they have, and will the IEC recognize you?
Thanks, Peter. It's really good to be on your podcast, and it's good to speak to you again. That was a really great introduction. So Groundwork Collective have been very busy in our civic education pillar, and we've been doing a lot of work, including registrations. I think we were one of the civil society organizations that registered the most new people onto the voters' roll. And we were looking for about, 2,000 people to be observers. And we currently are sitting at something close to 4,000, and we've actually had to now close the portal because otherwise we won't be able to afford to do it the way that it has to be, both logistically and financially. But I think with the amount that we have, we might be third only to the ANC and the DA in terms of coverage. So we're going to be able to cover about 21% of the country. And then we are accredited with the IEC. And one of the things that we obviously encounter a lot in our work is that there are lots of patriotic South Africans who want to get involved in democracy in their country. They don't necessarily want to do it with political parties. And so I think the great thing about what we've been doing at Groundwork Collective is giving them lots of different avenues for how they can come on board. And this is all mainly voluntary. Very few of them have even asked for stipends, for water. I think it's just people saying, they recognize the importance of the elections and they want to be a part in protecting it. So we are really just gathering them together and training them. And I think it's very exciting.
But just explain something to me, Mbali. I mean, how do you get from thinking about creating an observer corps before an election and actually getting to 4,000 people standing to attention and ready to receive their postings? I mean, first of all, who pays for all of this? Because it can't cost nothing.
Yes, it doesn't cost nothing. So, I mean, first of all, I think I'm lucky that in the civil society sector, I've also had a lot of political campaigning experience. So I understand very broadly the minutiae and the overarching logistics and things that you have to do to get done. So that included everything from us being able to develop an app that's going to be zero rated and that is in all official 11 languages. Can work offline and online, because obviously I've worked in very remote areas and I know that you need to be able to do a lot of work offline sometimes. And then the coordination of having people that are trained to be able to train these people in many different places. So my background in politics is very helpful in this sense. But we've had really great donors, both private individuals, some corporates. Who have also given us money to logistically put together a lot of the stuff that we do. And that's how we've been working. But as I say, for our observer portal, really, people have been so serious about this election. We've gotten people that have given us great pro bono rates. We also have digital billboards across the country, outside every spa, Shell. Maybe there's a digital billboard we've been given a really great rate by, a company like Oasis. We've had another very big teleco company come on board to say that they will zero rate our app. And some of these people don't want to be mentioned, and some of them are very happy to be mentioned, but we'll be putting all that information out when we do our big election report that we're going to put out freely and give to the country and the IEC and for anyone who wants to do future observation missions.
Yeah. And will you also then take the opportunity after the election to have a moment where you declare the election either free and fair or iffy or not free or fair but free, not free or free but not fair? I mean, do you pronounce afterwards after this huge effort that you're putting into it?
I mean, I think that we respect the work of the IEC and they typically are the ones that make that pronouncement. But obviously, we will share what our observations were and the data that we've collected. And we have stationed people across the country, but also particularly in places that we consider to be red zones. So those are places where either because of the density, because of past political violence in the areas, or because there might be wards where two or more political parties are on the margins to be able to take it. We really are stationing people on those kinds of roads because if there is going to be likely any kind of political, you know, integrity that's at stake, those are likely the places where it's going to happen. So even above where everyone's just ordinarily volunteered, we have stationed people as much as possible strategically there so that we'll have a good sample size. And I think from that, we'll be able to give a very clear idea of what happened in the election. And for us, we're also going to be using in the background to be able to create a modeling sort of application so that we can use the by-elections and other elections to then be able to say how accurate what we were getting and what actually happened in the on day is going to be. And I think that's going to be very helpful. And again, I'm not sure we have anyone in South Africa doing that.
Yeah. So just come back up, let's go back a little bit, Mbali. So you left the party in, I think, 20 or 21. And then you were quiet for a while, and suddenly there was this burst of Mbali and Thuli everywhere, and you started your new NGO. How did you, I mean, what was that like? I mean, what is it like starting something and going to people just with an idea and saying, this is what I want to do, please can I have R1 million?
Difficult. So I left in early 22, and I had an idea already that I wanted to go back into communities, and I thought, a lot of the stuff that I had said when I ran for the DA leadership was stuff that I wanted to do anyway. And I think that it would have been great to have been able to do it with a big institution and a big machinery behind it, because I think it was the kind of stuff that South Africans really want. But I didn't want to let go of the stuff that I had campaigned on that I thought was important. And so I reconceptualized it into a way that could now not have to happen in a political party, but could happen generally. And so I didn't join another political party, I didn't start one. I wanted to show that I was prepared to go back into communities and continue the work that I've been doing for the last sort of 2 decades. And I put in a lot of my money initially because people don't really believe either politicians, typically in South Africa, are going to do something and then not, you know, turn around and you know, form a political party. Or people don't think that you can do it because obviously a big part of the criticism that I was receiving when I ran in the DA was that I was young and that I was inexperienced, which was absolutely not true. So for me, it was also, a big fuck you that I could do it and I would be able to do it on my own. And so I used my own money for a long time and I got on with the work and I did it until I could showcase to people what we were wanting to do and what we started doing in communities. And I think once people see that you're serious and you're willing to put your own money behind it, and it is a privileged position to be in, then they were able to come on board. And all I do now really is fundraise the majority of time. I think I'm quite a good fundraiser. The DA missed a trick there.
Yeah. So, to give us just some idea quickly, I don't want to what sort of things have you done with help and with before you got the help that you now have?
So, I mean, obviously, we have our pillars in food production and access to water. And for us in the organization, what we'd conceptualize is that if you want people to care about democracy and to care about the country and to get involved, a lot of people in our country can't do that when they are living on the poverty line, when they're worried about what kind of food they or their children are going to eat. So you have to take care of that situation first when you want to go and speak to people. And again, this is for me a big part of how I was in politics, is you have to give people something
that they can see is of use to them before you start talking to them about, you know, vote for me or we can do something better. And that was something as simple as having just basic food pilots around the country where we were teaching people how to grow their own food, fortify the meals that they had, not have to use the entire grant on groceries, not have to use money that they could have used to go find a job on food, and to really give people the ability to use their hands again. I mean, a lot of people, I think, particularly Black people, for a long time had rural homesteads. And I know growing up that my gran would grow her own food. That's what she taught us. But you don't see it so much with the younger generations. You don't see it with people in urban areas. And I think that, you know, once we got into places and showed people that it was...
Is that because they've got nowhere to grow anything?
I don't even think that that's the main issue, because we also show people how to grow food in something as simple as old tires or in any sort of big... in any sort of object that can hold the compost. So it's not even necessarily just a land issue. It's because no one's taught them. And so that was the first thing. And then people sort of start to trust you and believe you. And they have something that is tangible that you've given them, and it costs nothing. And we've had great conversations with people like Wendy Desisrobo about how to really scale this up now, because we think that it's something that's really incredible and great, especially for young unemployed people, because they can always take the surplus and start selling it. So those are some of the first very simple, inexpensive things that we started with. And also simple things like linking up young people on our database and our portal to skills programs, mentorship programs, before we got to some of the big ticket items like registering people around the country, which does cost a lot of money because we were also using influencers and celebrities because we wanted to make it really cool for young people to build. But by then, I think people had bought in and we were able to fundraise money for that.
Yeah. So you're busy and you're all over the country. By the way, Wendy Desisrobo, for people who don't know, is a very well-known agricultural economist in South Africa, advisor to governments and private companies, and generally very thoughtful, very nice guy. And Bali, you're all over the place. You've got fingers in lots of pies. You know what's going on in the country. As we go into this election, what is your mood and how do you read the country?
So, again, I think because I've been in politics for a very long time, but I'm also not somebody who's running in this election, I've really had a really good, I think, backseat view to a lot of the political parties, because I still talk to a lot of them and I hear what they have to say, and I'm hearing a lot of what's happening behind the scenes. And I find that many of the political parties in our country are for the first time really recognizing that there's now a feeling amongst the electorate that they're no longer going to accept just anything from political parties. And on the one hand, it has people very scared about what that looks like for their futures, particularly established parties, because I think to some degree they're the ones that have been acting with the most impunity. But also a lot of excitement from new parties that they finally have an electorate that might be willing to give a chance to something new. And my feeling, despite a lot of people's sort of feelings of doom and gloom because it's such a highly contested election and there's so many political parties, is that this is great. It's great for us as a country to have this amount of contestation, this amount of choice, quite frankly. And this is why we have to become active citizens and that we can actually understand what's at stake and how these governments work, because for a long time we've left that out to either be the work of political parties or the IEC to teach us how governments work. And I think with the continued awareness and conversation, more and more people are now getting to the fact that they actually need to understand the rules of the game so that they can play for themselves. And so, I mean, I'm no Sangoma, but I think that the ANC will be below 50%, not as drastically as some of the polls are showing. I don't think they'll be in the 30s. I think probably around 47%. And I think psychologically for the country, what that does is it shows us that, it's actually possible to have a change in government, or it's possible for this to happen. Maybe we should get serious about this. Maybe we should re-enter into the political conversation, not be so apathetic, because things can change. So for my side, I'm very excited with the focus grouping that we're doing with young people, particularly that we've registered and that we engage with. You see a sense of them. From last year, they were sort of unsure about who they could vote for. They didn't want any of the established parties, but they didn't know enough about what else was there. Obviously, when we register them, we also do a great, you know, curriculum with them to teach them about very different things. But even the ones that haven't gone through that, this year when we've done more focus groups, are really showing a keener awareness of what's happening, who the political players are, and some of the big issues that are happening in conversations. So I think it's a great step in the right direction for us, and I'm optimistic, even if it means that we're going to have some rocky coalitions in KZN and Gauteng for a little while. But we must also grow up as South Africans, and we must understand that the only way out is through the contact for democracy, and we must all participate if we want the outcomes that we want.
So the reason I wanted to talk to you on this show, one of the prime reasons, was because of the election, because you grew up in KZN and your politics has been all KZN, as I understand it. And I wondered if you'd help me and listeners understand what it's like to do politics in that province, because it just sounds so dangerous and so scary. But they're your streets, aren't they? I mean, you know them by day and in the dark of night. What's it like to go out with a badge, with a political party T-shirt on your shoulders, and knock on doors in deep rural KwaZulu-Natal?
I love it. And I've always loved it. And I think you have to have a degree of some sort of insanity to be in politics and to do that. And before I even was an MPL, when I was a councillor, my ward where I stood was in Duzuma, which was actually against my uncle who was in the ANC, who then also got shot during this election, but he survived. I didn't win, but I did win the most votes for the ANC at the time. And I mean, I suppose I say he got shot like it's something ordinary, because it has become very ordinary in KZN. I know many people that have been shot or have had attempts on their lives, including people that were across the bench from us, in council. I was at the council meeting where a certain member of another political party shot someone in front of all of us and, the TV crews. It has, I think, become far too normalized, the level of violence that there are around political killings. But I suppose you kind of think it's par for course when you're there. And so often, I stood there. I was also in Ananda, which had for me, Nelson Mandela, I voted for the first time at the JL Dubin Museum. It had the Phoenix settlement in it. And it had Impala Meni, which is the home of the Shembe Church. And so my politics in KZN was very much in the communities of KZN, understanding that. And then, of course, I was in MPL in a very rural, deep rural place for the DA. I always enjoyed challenge, so I always enjoyed it. But it is difficult and it is hard. But I would say that of all the provinces, KZN is the one where voters are most likely to be open to listening to you. And I think that's why you also get the plethora of political parties that can and get some kind of support there. So you have the NFP, you have the MS, Al-Jaman, Action SA did incredibly well there for only being in about six different wards. So it is the kind of place, and maybe it's because it's homogenous, because it's a majority, it's those are people that you don't have to deal with too much of, sort of the tribal issues around it. You really deal on a party-to-party basis and what you can bring with people. So I think it's the most exciting place for this to be in South Africa, and that's why it continues to always be the battlefield for the political parties. If you do a good enough job there, you can get some sort of traction. But it is violent. It is increasingly becoming violent. And I think one of the things that's scary is that the violence is also conflated with a lot of government business. And that's why you see the rise of the construction cartels and the construction mafias. That's why the taxi industry is the strongest, but also has a lot of influence in the way that government also does its work there. And so I suppose in a way, Gauteng might be the center in terms of the economy, but I think for a big part of the politics and the heart of the direction of many of the political parties, it starts in KZN.
Do you think, I mean, you talk about the province being homogenous, predominantly, overwhelmingly Zulu, but is there, I mean, are Zulu people different in from the rest of us? Are they particularly difficult to govern? I mean, why, at the moment you have, you've got a lot of parties, not really, and these are black-led parties, not saying violently different things. There's no separatism, as far as I can see, in any of the pronouncements politically that in the province. But why is it so hard? Why is it so complex if it's homogenous?
So when I say homogenous, I just mean to campaign there, you don't have to think about, you know, necessarily speaking in different languages to different people, because so many of the people there, even if they aren't Zulu, understand Zulu because they've lived there for so long. So it takes it, what makes it easier, I think, politically to campaign. But on the other hand, because it is so homogenous, I think that the electorate is very picky, quite frankly, about how they go about who they choose. And that's why sometimes they'll throw, you know, a bone to the people that make them happy. Team Sugar that won in Newcastle, and I'll say allegedly, although it's quite well known. I mean, one of the ways that he got many people to vote for him to become mayor was he went out and bought a whole bunch of furniture and beds and things that people have been asking for. Those people are definitely mainly IFP and ANC, but they're very happy to give their vote for whoever will do what they need at that time. And that's KZN politics. When I was in rural Mkanyo, they didn't know the DA, but we did enough work, we bought some houses, we did a lot of people saw that. They were like, yeah, we'll give this girl a chance. She seems cool. So I think they're also spoiled for choice and they know it. But what I don't understand is there hasn't been better governance, and particularly in Northern KZN, where there is a big fight between the IFP and the ANC for running different municipalities, and they have been for a long time running different municipalities. You don't see much of a difference in either of those two parties in terms of service delivery. But if you watch the by-elections and the way that elections swing, you do see that people are willing to go from sometimes one to the other, which makes KZN interesting, where like you can just come in and try something. And now we've seen it. 6 months ago, someone wouldn't have put their MK. And now we have a very different look of what that's going to look like.
Yeah. But is there a fault line that you know, are there fault lines that don't move in KwaZulu? I mean, you know, if does an IFP voter, Inkatha Freedom Party voter, move effortlessly across lines as well as an ANC voter? Or are there lines that you don't cross?
I think it's mainly age dependent now. I think the IFP has got the lion's share of older people, and particularly people in rural areas that are governed by strong Isindunas or Amakhosi, whereas the ANC voting patterns are a bit more fluid and they're more peri-urban and urban than rural, I think, contrary to what many people believe when they see some of the results that come from KZN. And there still is a very, obviously, huge population that votes for the ANC in KZN, and so they do a lot of their work there and in township areas. But I mean, even in rural KZN, you also had a lot of white communities that would vote for the IFP who thought that it was the better of the two options in front of them. The DA has made a few inroads, not nearly enough. And I think this election will be interesting once again. But when the NFP also broke away from the IFP, we know that they did incredibly well and took away the IFP's ability to continue to be the official opposition. In 2011. So,
yeah.
Again, there's also a big element of personality politics that happens there with people that they trust.
Now, I was going to say, another big question about KwaZulu-Natal is why Durban has collapsed so spectacularly. I mean, how does the ANC, I mean, KwaZulu is full of clever people. How does the ANC contrive to put a mayor in charge of probably the second most important city economically in the country, and walk away when this guy, or when the thing creates such an absolute disaster?
I think similarly to what's happened in other places, but more pronounced in KZN, is that I don't think the ANC runs the government on their own. I think there are very strong business interests that are also willing to use violence to get what they want. And in fact, it's an open secret to some people that there are some very strong families, one that's in the news currently, that really is putting the strings of what happened in Itsekiri. And their focus is, of course, on to make as much money as possible. If the infrastructure and the sewage system is not being taken care of, that's neither here nor there for them. And I don't think that the ANC is able to pull themselves out of that rut anymore because it goes so deeply. And it's not just the people at the top, it's in supply chain, it's in procurement, it's the people that work there, it's the people that have, you know, family members that they put in. It's the ward members that now get R1,000 because of a pronouncement that was made by the former mayor for them to be able to get it. It's just too big to unravel at this point, and we actually need for the ANC to lose power so that the taps of patronage can be closed for people. And there's no other way to do it without having many parties in there to do a check and balance, because all that will happen is that they'll just shoot and kill people that get in their way. But they can't do that if it's multiple parties, because it's not worthwhile. There'll always be someone else in another party to come up. Whereas in the ANC, they've got deep enough claws that they can have people do what they want. That's my honest opinion. We talk about, you know, governance and state. At the end of the day, I think what's happening in Durban is massive corruption and violence.
Just and driven by one family, or I don't want to get you into trouble, and I don't have to mention any names, but I mean, would it be one local?
No, I think there's a number, but there's probably ones that are more prominent than others, and across the demographic groups, I think that there's at least one for each that are all very well known in KZN. And I mean, and to some degree, it's even a running joke now amongst some residents of KZN that they can't say which some of these families are because nobody wants to be visited, you know, at nights.
Yeah, yeah. Enter then Jacob Zuma, and everything goes completely crazy. So the ANC was looking comfortable in KwaZulu-Natal, despite what's going on in Durban, up until December, when suddenly Jacob Zuma launches his party, or somebody launches the party, which then declares him to be its leitmotif and now leader. How do you explain his appeal in KZN? You know, despite all we know about him, he ran an absolutely crooked administration as president. He ran the economy into the ground, and you know, what is it? Is it the fact that he's Zulu and can't do any wrong in the eyes of people in the province? Or where does he derive his bounce appeal? You know, he's bounced back. I mean, he's going to define the election one way or another.
I think Zuma is very personable and well-liked in KZN. I think that is also because of the way that he tells the story of what he believes he was doing with the presidency. So you and I may have read, you know, what was happening at the Zondo Commission and the economics, but if you listen to him speak on Izwid Omzansi or Kwazi FM about what he was doing, it was very hard to argue with the way that he would frame, I think, a lot of the stuff that he was doing with president, number one. Number two, people love an underdog story, and Cyril Ramaphosa is not popular in KZN, and so you hear quite often on the airwaves of different channels or in conversations with people that a lot of people are saying they're not voting for MK because they aren't ANC, but they're voting against Ramaphosa's ANC and Ramaphosa's arrogance and what Ramaphosa has done. And that might be a little bit unfair in that he's now, you know, having the dregs of having clean up what happened when they wasted 9 years. But perception in politics is also everything to the voter. And so that's what it seems and is perceived to be. And then, of course, you know, they decided to take Jacob Zuma into jail, probably the most high-profile person at that level, and it seemed unfair. And the way, again, that the president is able to frame the narrative about making himself victim is incredibly powerful. And so he's able to put people up into a frenzy. But make no mistake, they are well-organized administratively, and I thought about this for much longer than when they came out in December, and they clearly have good financial resources. The other thing is that people in this country have realized that if you want to make quick money, politics is probably the best way to get close enough to people to be able to do that or to be able to catch on their coattails something that comes down the line. So I also think that a lot of people are opportunistically helping the MK, hoping that they'll be able to get something because it's very clear that they will make it into the legislature. And so it's also hedging their bets.
Yeah. And just come back to Cyril Ramaphosa then. So I think he spent the weekend, he might still even be there in KwaZulu-Natal as we speak on Monday. to go there. First of all, you can tell me, does his Tsuru speak good Zulu? I mean, what would he sound like to a Zulu audience?
I mean, I think he just sounds like somebody who speaks another language trying to speak Zulu. He'll say the right words. I don't think that he's able to bring out the passion as much as, you know, a mother tongue speaker can, or to sort of use colloquialisms and maybe idioms and metaphors as much as, you know, people like the former president can. There's really no question there. But I mean, even like someone like Julius Malema really struggles in Kensington. He's also seen as very disrespectful, particularly by elder people too. And he's also not very popular there. But I think for me, the most ironic thing about this election, and the one that I like the most, is that I like that the ANC's demise and problems are coming from one of their own, and from a complete invention of a man that they made outside and bigger than the ANC, and he's utilizing and capitalizing on that popularity to whatever, you know, he wants to do, whether he wants to be a background operator to run the province remotely, or whether he wants to use this to force some cases not to go against him, whatever. But it's delicious to watch that it happens by their own hand, and probably the best outcome that we could have hoped for actually in the country. So in this case, maybe we should really thank former President Zuma.
Yeah. So how do you think the province will vote on May 29th? What's the likeliest outcome?
I think that ANC will still be the biggest party, but will not be close to 50%. I think maybe sort of 38. And then I think MK has a serious shot at potentially, you know, sort of getting in the 18 to 25%, which is unheard of, quite frankly. But that's what the polls say, and certainly judging by the atmosphere on the ground, and they really are everywhere. I mean, I've seen MK in Durban North and in Mhlanga, which you wouldn't think were in typical constituents, but clearly they are trying to be everywhere and to show people that they are on the ground and to scare the ANC, quite frankly. And I think and the number of political events that I've been to, there seems to be major tension, and we've seen some of them playing out in the way that, you know, certain leaders are snatching mics away from people or making heated comment in the media.
Yes, yes.
I think that the bigger question is, after the elections, Bruce, who do all these people come together with? Because it's clear that there's no one winner in KZN. So you're either going to have an ANC MK or ANC main EFF, but EFF's not big enough to do anything. ANC DA, but they don't hate each other in KZN. That's for me.
ANC IFP?
Maybe. But the IFP is not big enough to help the ANC at a national level, unless the ANC really is at sort of 47%. Then that makes sense, that that will be the most likely outcome. They'll give the IFP KZN, and then IFP helps them to win national.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And there'll be different arrangements with the EFF, perhaps in Gauteng and other provinces. I think they'll make arrangements as the numbers guide them. And Bali, thanks so much. I've done my best to avoid your old party, the DA. Recent polls give it a shot at 25% of the national vote, which I think is a bit ambitious, a bit optimistic. But I could see 23% happening. Does the current leadership of the DA, in knowing the party as you do, does it survive below 23%?
I think the DA's biggest concern this election is going to be having to get those voters out. My sense generally is that they're not going to grow much in the black demographic, and white people and, you know, Indian people that have voted for them, to some degree, I think will be doing it with a bit of a grudge vote because they haven't seen anything else that they think is better. But I think that they might plateau. Either they stay where they are, or 23 is the highest I would put them. I saw another poll that put them close to 30. That's certainly where the DA should be, considering how much the work they've done and how they could have been the alternatives to the ANC. But I don't see them going beyond 25. And I think if they decline for a third time, that starts to send some real warning bells about the future of the party. And if the party decides to go into the coalition with the ANC, as you know, the leader has been saying they might consider, I think it dies after that. I don't think the DA will have the capacity to both be in government and take all the things that they have left into those positions and still have enough of the drift of leadership to keep the party running. And maybe that's a worthwhile trade for them to try and keep the stability as they believe they would of the party for the next, or the country for the next 5 years. But I think then the rise of actions and rise in Zantes and other parties will over time eat into their base if they're not going to be able to be on the ground. But with the current leadership, I don't think they've done a good enough job to really reach out to new voters. And certainly with the focus group we've done with young people, the DA across, again, demographics is not something that is really on their radar as a party that they consider as an alternative.
Yeah, it's a sad story. I got one last question. So your dad ran a taxi company, right? He was a taxi boss in KwaZulu-Natal. And he died when you were young. But somebody was telling me the other day that you are in the taxi business yourself. Was that wrong? Do you run a taxi company? Are you a taxi boss?
Taxi mafia. My family is obviously still in taxis. My mom's been running it for years. And before I had children, I was helping her to a large extent also to run it. And she was hoping to, sort of make me full-time in there. But I have young kids at the moment, 5-year-old and then nearly 2-year-old. So I'd like them to sort of grow up a little bit before I get back into it, because it's obviously by the nature of the business is full on every day. And you have to be very focused because it's also the kind of industry where it's easy to steal, which is also why there's a lot of violence, because you have to keep discipline in that sense. I'm not condoning that. I'm just saying it's one of the things that happens. And it's also the kind of industry where you have to constantly have your wits about you. And I'm just not in the space right now to do it to the level that I would need to. But yes, my family's still in them. My mom runs them on our behalf as a family. I do have and she does that. But anytime she needs me to help out, and I mean, I've done a couple of videos on social media where I show people, because people also forget who I am because I sound and have had private schooling. And this is the mistake I think the DA also did, is that then you must be one-dimensional. But I grew up around taxi ranks and grew up in, you know, deep cultural isiZulu stuff. So people must be reminded that I'm a complex and a real child of South Africa.
Bali and Tulu, you're also such a star. Thank you very much for coming onto this show, and lots of good luck monitoring the election. Good luck with the NGO, with Groundwork Collective. Good luck with the family taxi business. I'm sure, like me, you can't wait to see what the results are. On May the 30th. Thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it, and see you back here next week. Bye bye. Be safe.